Hello, everybody. My name is David Everson, and I'm a recovered alcoholic.
Hi, David.
I'm grateful to be alive, grateful to be here, grateful to be sober and awake in Alcoholics Anonymous, a program that absolutely saved my life 10 years and one day ago today. I know where I would be if it was not for God and Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'll talk a little bit about that, how I got here. But first and foremost, I want to thank Denise and thank the group for inviting me to share my experience over the last these last 4 weeks. It's been a tremendous experience, a real learning experience for me, and a real blessing. And I thank you. My home group is A Vision for You. We meet in Union on Thursday nights. It's a big book step study meeting. A speaker comes in to our group and speaks on a step, and then we share. About that step the following week. So over the course of 3 months, we go through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. The only time we deviate from that is the first Thursday of every quarter. We invite someone in to speak on the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. So in January, it's traditions 1, 2, 3. April, 4, 5, 6. Well, you get the idea. So through the course of a whole year, we have a speaker on the traditions to learn where we came from and how we work. As groups. My sponsor is Walter M. He has the same sober date as me, only 15 years my senior. Mm-hmm. And my service sponsor is Wayne Ross. I'm a real alcoholic. I definitely am a real alcoholic, and I'm going to share a little bit out of page 20 and 21 in our text. In the chapter there is a solution, chapter 2, that delineates the different types of drinkers. And start at the very bottom of 20. Moderate drinkers have little trouble giving up liquor entirely if they have good reason for it. They can take or leave it alone. And I put in parentheses there, that person has power, choice, and control. Then we have a certain type of hard drinker. He may have the habit badly enough to actually impair him physically and mentally. It may cause him to die a few years before his time. If a sufficiently strong reason, ill health, falling in love, change of environment, or the warning of a doctor becomes operative, this man can also stop or moderate, although he may find it difficult and troublesome, and may even need medical attention. I also wrote there, he has power of control also. But what about the real alcoholic? He may start off as a moderate drinker. He may or may not become a continuous hard drinker, but at some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his liquor consumption once he starts to drink. And that was me, clearly. I have the three elements of the disease of alcoholism, the obsession of the mind, that if it were not for God in AA, that all I would think about every waking moment was about my next drink, where it was going to come from. Make sure that I had a bottle of vodka somewhere, or some wine at the very least, something in the trunk of my car, or under my bed, or in the closet, because I couldn't stand the thought about waking up in the morning and not being able to grab a hold of a drink, because if not, my hands would be shaking, and I would be miserable until I could get that ease and comfort from getting that first drink. So I was obsessed with drinking, and it really directed my life. The phenomenon of craving is the second part, where once I have a drink, it demands the next drink, and it demands the drink after that. And that intensity, it just gets worse and worse. It's never satisfied. It just intensifies that craving. So I'll drink until I pass out. And that happened so many, many hundreds of times over the last 35 years of my drinking. 35 years, really, from when I started in college until God separated me in June 24, 2007. Now, I look back, and I like to think, or at least I put in my notes, that maybe those first 10 years of my drinking, I was a social drinker, quote-unquote, but I look back now, and I think, really, I'm just kidding myself, because I like the effect of booze just from the get-go. I couldn't wait to have that next drink, because it made me feel free. It made me feel a part of. It made me feel good. It made me feel welcome. It made me feel comfortable in my own skin, which brings me to the third part of my disease of alcoholism, is a spiritual malady. That from a time I was a little kid, I just felt like I didn't fit in, that everybody seemed to know the rules or just unspoken rules of life, but I didn't. And I was always trying to play catch-up, it seemed, and I was very frustrated by that. I didn't feel like I was a part of even my own family, for crying out loud. And that was long before there was a drink. but I had this spiritual malady. Mm-hmm. That's what drives, I think, my mind to tell me to drink. When things get tough, when things don't go well for me, or if I'm anxious about something that's coming up, it's go and drink, and that drives it. So those are those three phases of that disease of alcoholism that I have so clearly. Over those, let's say, 30 years of those 35 years, I began to have consequences. It would affect my relationships with my family, with my loved ones, even my friends. It would affect my job performance, my ability to keep a job. And no matter the job later on, I was always in the back of my mind while I was at work, when am I going to get off so I can have a drink? Witnessed my last job with a pharmaceutical company in San Diego for 19 years. At least half of that time, I couldn't wait to make my last doctor's call because I wanted to get home and start drinking, because that craving, that obsession was just kicking in and it was getting stronger and stronger, and I needed that relief. And so I had the consequences from the law, with DUI stops and arrests and convictions for DUIs. I clearly was an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. But don't tell me about it, because I'm arrogant, I'm defensive, and I'm obnoxious when I drink, and I don't have a problem. You're the one that has a problem. And maybe some of you are familiar with that argument that goes on in your family with people that care about us. It went on with me a lot. Always in denial. Always arrogant, and always defensive about drinking. But deep down, I know that they were right, because I am drinking too much, and I deep down in my innermost self, I know that I can't stop drinking either. But I keep telling myself that someday it'll be different. Someday I'll be able to get control of this and drink like a normal person. Never happened. Never, ever happened. So, some dates for you, and then I'll get into steps 10, 11, and 12. February of 2002 is when I lost that job with that pharmaceutical company. And it was for falsification of records, because I was fully intending to go out and make a full day's work and call on doctors I'm supposed to be doing, leaving samples of our products, encouraging the right prescriptions for our drugs, etc., etc. But first thing in the morning, I had to have a little screwdriver and then another little one while I'm getting ready, watching the Today Show on TV and getting my suit on. And more often than not, it's 10:30 in the morning and I'm drunk and I haven't even gone out the door yet. And so I start figuring out that I'm going to make more calls tomorrow and I'm going to double up and I'm just in that playing catch up there, and there's all this drama going on in my head, and my performance at a job is going downhill. No wonder they fired me, but it really had to do with the booze, of course. Next date was October of 2002. I lost my job in February, but it took until October of that year before my family convinced me to come back here to New Jersey from San Diego to help take care of my mother, who was in her 90s. My dad had died 2 years before. And then Walker helped come home and help take care of Mom. And I did. We look back, we wonder who was taking care of who, because all I did was drink. And it was five more years of that. The last two, I became a garage drinker. And all I did was listen to the radio out in the garage and just drink vodka. And then God separated me from alcohol on June 24, 2007. And we talked last week about 6 and 7, and 5, 6, and 7, and 8 and 9, and I had a wonderful experience of my ninth step. I was apprehensive about it, but the ninth step calls that I made, I was well coached on what I should say and what it was about, and more importantly, what I should not do. And I had a wonderful experience, and I learned a lot. I learned the details of that hospital trip on June 24th, 10 years ago, where I was taken by helicopter over to St. Luke's Hospital in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. That's why I woke up in that hospital bed with all these wires and tubes, and I didn't know where I was. Couldn't speak because I had a tracheotomy. I learned also that while I was taken over to the hospital, that I was on the roof of the hospital for some time because my organs were shutting down, and they didn't even know if they were going to get me off the roof, get me down to ICU, but they eventually did, and I woke up in intensive care. So I learned some of those details. I learned while I was making amends to my sister what my siblings had to say, because I learned from making amends to her that the whole weight of my wellness rested on her shoulders. She lived down the block, and she could see that I was destroying my life and everything around it. And she would call her brothers and say, "Well, David's got a drinking problem." And they said, "Well, what are you going to do about it?" They were clueless, just as she was clueless, because I'm the only drunk in the family. And all that frustration and worry was all on her shoulders, watching her brother die. But part of that was a comment that she had in a conversation with one of our nieces, who's a PharmD, a doctor of pharmacy, at the time at Johns Hopkins. And she said, "Well, Uncle David will either bleed out and die tonight, or he'll start to get better." Because I had ulcerated my esophagus so bad from the vodka, and the wonder that triggered the grand mal seizures that I had, why they found me in my bedroom in my mom's home in a pool of blood. So I learned a lot during those that nine-step amends process. I later learned something that came up later on when we were talking about amends last week. One day I was driving with my sister near our house, and we were going over to Phillipsburg, and we went to ride this little baseball field. And that ball field's still there today. And she said, "You see that field over there?" And I said, "Yeah." She said, "That's where the paramedics had to get permission to land a helicopter to take you to Pennsylvania, to the hospital." I drive by there, and I think, well, there's a ball field. Mm-hmm. She drives by there and thinks, "That's where my baby brother almost died that horrible night." One more thing, sobering thought, hardened upon about the damage that I've caused. I also learned that the depthness of the people in my family and loved ones that really cared about me and my well-being. They didn't know what to do about my alcoholism, but they were concerned and they were trying to find out, and they did a lot of research, and they helped my sister all she could. So it was really impressed upon me, the depth of their care and their concern and their love for me. Because I just felt absolutely worthless and hopeless and full of remorse about what I had become before I had that seizure. I also came to realize very clearly that God was with me every step of that way. As I mentioned before, when I woke up in that hospital bed after I was there a while, I remember hearing this quiet little voice very clearly saying, "You're done." And I believe that voice was God, because he'd had enough. And I listened to that very clearly, and now I'm ready to go to any lengths to get help. And then on with the path to a rehab stay up near West Point at St. Christopher's Inn, and almost 3 years at a sober house, an Oxford house nearby here. And during that process, coming to AA meetings every day and meeting a sponsor, and now having a home group and starting on my path in recovery. So, if we can pop to page 83, I'm just going to finish up a little bit about step 9. After making my amends, about a third of the way down the page on 83, it says, "The spiritual life is not a theory, we have to live it. Unless one's family expresses a desire to live upon the spiritual principles, we think we ought not to urge them. We should not talk incessantly to them about spiritual matters." This is more making my amends. "They will change in time. Our behavior will convince them more than our words. We must remember that 10 or 20 years of drunkenness would make a skeptic out of anyone." And this comes up to me a lot when I talk to people about how do I make amends to my family. They won't even talk to me. And the best answer that I can give is do what you're doing. Because you may not notice it, but as time goes by, people will notice the change in you. And that was the case with me. "There may be some wrongs that can never be fully right. We don't worry about them if we can honestly say to ourselves that we would right them if we could." And I mentioned last week about my not being able to make amends to my second ex-wife, who I learned just recently had died after I was about a year sober. I had no idea about that. I can't make amends to her. And that weighed on me a lot. But now to the bottom of the page, the 9-step promises, which are very key to my recovery as I was learning more about this book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and even before I had a sponsor, I was told to read those 9-step promises. If we're painstaking about this phase of our development, we'll be amazed before we're halfway through. We're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feelings of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They always materialize if we work for them. I read that, and I say that it's important to me because as I was starting my and doing my 9-step amends, those promises slowly began to be coming true for me. And that just amazed me, that every little by little, something else would pop up, and I would just feel that much more free and feel that more closer to my Creator and to the people around me. So 9-step promises, big things for me. Okay, so this thought brings us to step 10. Which suggests that we continue to take personal inventory and continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. We have vigorously commenced this way of living as we cleaned up the past. We have entered the world of the Spirit. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. This is not an overnight matter. It should continue for our lifetime. And here's the instructions for step 10. Continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. When these crop up, we ask God at once to remove them. We discuss them with someone immediately and make amends quickly if we have harmed anyone. Then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. Love and tolerance of others is our code. Now, I've heard a lot, and I used to say, because I didn't know any better, I said, well, these are the maintenance steps 10, 11, and 12. And that implies that I've done all the work, and now I just have to like fine-tune things as I go along. And these are not maintenance steps for me. Because if I look at them as being maintenance steps, then I'm just sort of like coasting, and I just need to put a little gas here, there, and a little gas there, and otherwise I'm just cruising along. And I've learned through my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous that if I'm coasting, I'm in trouble, because I always need to be driving towards this, because I still have those character defects, and I still have that alcoholic mind. A mind that wants me dead and will take me and will settle for me drunk, and my mind will always try and take me back to a drink. So if I look at these steps 10, 11, and 12 as just maintenance steps that pretty much the hard work is already done, I'm asking for trouble, because I'm really telling myself that I only need to go through half measures from here on out, and that's going to spell disaster for a guy like me, because I'll be making excuses, and my lying mind is always going to be there lying in wait for me to suddenly pop up the idea that a drink might be a good idea. I also want to remember here that in my first step experience, which is why I talked about the first step earlier, about me being a real alcoholic, on pages 1 to 43 is about the first step in AA. Pages 23 to 43 is about the mind. Page 17 to 23 is about the body. And if I'm honest, I have to follow these instructions on step 10. So otherwise, I'll be back to, on my road to having a drink. I made a note here in my margin that in step 10, I have to be on guard for me to show up. Because that's really what it boils down to. That alcoholic mind is still lying there in wait. So on to step 11. Before I get there, hang on. A little more about step 10. The step 10 promises, which at our home group in Union and Vision for You, we read this 10 step promises at the close of every meeting before we end with the Lord's Prayer. And we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol. By this time, sanity will have returned. We will seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil from it as from a hot flame. We act sanely and normally. And we will find that this has happened automatically. We will see that our new attitude toward liquor has given us without has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That is the miracle of it. We are not fighting it. Neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we are placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We've not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. We're neither cocky nor are we afraid. That is our experience. That is how we react so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition. I introduce myself as a recovered alcoholic because I am. But I'm not cured. There's no cure for alcoholism. I'm only a recovered alcoholic because I follow the outline, the design for living that's in this book, and strive to be of service to my Creator and to my fellows, and by that I mean keeping fit spiritual condition. It's easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. We're talking a little bit about earlier about the half measures and about the maintenance steps and such, because we're headed for trouble if we do, because alcohol is a subtle foe. We've already talked about that. We're not cured of alcoholism. What we have is a daily reprieve continued on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Every day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into all of our activities. How can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. These are thoughts which must go with us constantly. We can exercise our willpower along this line if we wish, is the proper use of the will. Much has already been said about receiving strength, inspiration, and direction from Him who has all knowledge and power. If we have carefully followed directions, we have begun to sense the flow of His Spirit into us. To some extent, we have become God conscious. We have begun to develop this vital sixth sense. But we must go further, and that means more action. Step 11 suggests prayer and meditation. We shouldn't be shy of this matter of prayer. Better men than we are using it constantly. It works if we have a proper attitude and work for it. It would be easy to be vague about this matter, yet we believe we can make some definite and valuable suggestions. And I wanted particularly to read these two areas here on step 11, on page 86. When we retire at night, we constructively review our day. Were we resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? Do we owe an apology? Have we kept something to ourselves which should be discussed with another person at once? Were we kind and loving towards all? What could we have done better? Were we thinking of ourselves most of the time? Or were we thinking of what we could do for others, what we could pack into the stream of life? But we must be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection, for that would diminish our usefulness to others. After making our review, we ask God's forgiveness and inquire what corrective measures should be taken. So I need to always be searching at bedtime as I review my day. What was good? Well, good things pop up easily, but where did I fall short? And there are a lot of times and a lot of areas every single day that I've noticed that I fall short here, there, and a lot of things are the same thing over and over again, things that I really need to work on and continue to work on. But they're not going to go away unless I can continue to work on them, and with God's help, asking Him to remove them. On awakening, we let us think about the 24 hours ahead. We consider our plans for the day. Before we begin, we ask God to direct our thinking, especially asking that it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives. Under these conditions, we can employ our mental faculties with assurance, for after all, God gave us brains to use. Our thought life will be placed on a much higher plane when our thinking is cleared of wrong motives. Again, self trying to creep in. In thinking about our day, we may face indecision. We may not be able to determine which course to take. Here we ask God for inspiration, an intuitive thought or decision. We relax and take it easy. We don't struggle. We're often surprised at how the right answers come after we have tried this for a while. What used to be a hunch or the occasional inspiration gradually becomes a working part of the mind. Being still inexperienced and having just made conscious contact with God, it is not probable that we are going to be inspired at all times. We might pay for this presumption in all sorts of absurd actions and ideas. Nevertheless, we find that our thinking will, as time passes, be more and more on the plane of inspiration. We come to rely on it. We usually conclude a period of meditation with a prayer that is shown all throughout the day. what our next step is to be, and that we'll be given whatever we need to take care of such problems. We especially ask for freedom from self-will and be careful to make no requests for ourselves only. We may ask for ourselves, however, if others will be helped. We are careful never to pray for our own selfish ends. Many of us have wasted a lot of time doing that and it doesn't work, and you can easily see why. I wanted to get to this part. As circumstances warrant, we may ask our wives or friends to join us in morning meditation. If we belong to a religious denomination which requires a definite morning devotion, we attend that also. If not members of religious bodies, we sometimes select and memorize a few set prayers which emphasize the principles we have been discussing. There are helpful books also. Suggestions about these may be obtained from one's priest, minister, or rabbi. Be quick to see where religious people are right. Make use of what they offer. I put on the bottom there in the margin that I wrote, do I have a drinking problem or a spiritual problem? Drinking program or a spiritual program? Because if I came to AA, and I did, to try and stop drinking, I realized that drinking wasn't my problem. My problem was my thinking. My problem was my selfishness, my self-centered, my self-seeking, my dishonesty, the way I tried to control life, and if everything went the way I wanted to go on every given situation, everything was great. If not, then I got resentments, and problems started to pile up, all in my mind, because my mind's a predator. As I was going through this work, my sponsor had only suggested that I get one book outside of AA. He has since then, but just while I was going through these steps, and it was a book called The Four Agreements, by Dom Miguel Ruiz, I believe. It's a short little book, but The Four Agreements have really been a touchstone for me as I go through my daily life. The first agreement is to be impeccable with my word. The second agreement is
never make an assumption.
No, that's the third. The second one is don't take anything personal. And the third one is not make assumptions. And the fourth is to always do my best. And if I live my life by not making assumptions and not taking things personal and always being clear and true to my word and always doing my best, I can't go wrong. And so I'm glad to have that guidance to be directed that way. So, working with others on step 12. Now I want to read on page 60 what it says about step 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Now, as I look at the 12th step, and as I've looked at the 12th step over the years, I thought, well, this is about sponsorship, about sponsoring other people and sharing the message with them and helping the alcoholic that's sick and suffering. And that's true. So give you a little background about me. I've sponsored four guys in the last 10 years. The first gentleman was living in a sober house with me. He relapsed. He was sent down to Florida to a rehab. He came back from that rehab a changed man. Kind of remind me of Ebby meeting with Bill Wilson. Fresh-faced and glowing and all that, because you could just see the light in his eyes, and boy, this is great. And then we sort of lost contact, and the last I heard, he had moved back to Florida, and I don't know if he's drinking now or not. But for a while there, it looked like he was getting this, and I was very encouraged. The next guy that I sponsored died. He died sober, but he had a heart disease, and he died when he was starting to work on his fourth step. The next guy that I sponsored changed sponsors, and it really was a geographical situation because he lived way down by Neptune and didn't drive, and I live out by Phillipsburg, and whenever I would see him, it would be 75 miles one way, and it was going 150 miles when I would see him a few times a week, and it was a strain just financially on top of everything else. But his higher power led him to a man that lived right in his neighborhood that was going to big book meetings where he was going, and he asked if apologetically if it would be okay if he changed sponsors. I said, by all means. So I know he's in good hands. So that's why. The next guy, he's been with us for several years. He's been very active, giving much of himself to AA and to others. And he's relapsed time and time again. He's back with us now. And we're very grateful for that. So I look at the four guys that I've sponsored, and I think, I know that God puts me in some place so he can teach me something. And with my feeble mind, this is what I think I've learned from those men who have shared their lives with me, those four guys. One, that I can't keep anybody sober. Also, from the same gentleman, I learned that I can have a job as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous with integrity. Quote, God is my employer. This guy, first guy that I sponsored, helped me get a job at Bob's at Bob's Furniture. It was a tough job, but I would not have had that job without him. And I'm grateful for that. And I mentioned about God as my employer because I don't know if I mentioned this before, but when I got the job, I sent a text message to my sponsor telling him that I got the job, and that was his reply, God is your employer. He didn't say congratulations or good for you. He said, God is your employer. And I took that to heart, and I made sure that all the customers that I saw and people that I dealt with, I did my very best to be of service to them and to be a man of integrity. And when I left, they actually didn't want me to leave. Not because my sales were so great, but because they liked me. And I thought, well, thank you, God, for that experience. The third guy, who I mentioned the next guy, he died sober. He was starting his fourth step. When I was at his funeral, I had a long visit with his family, and they were very, very grateful for his time in Alcoholics Anonymous. For what the program had brought to him and to their lives. So my takeaway message from that is that God's timing is God's timing. It's not mine. And if it was his time, it was his time. But I'm grateful to have had that experience. And the other guy that changed sponsored, I mentioned about the geographic situation. But that guy was a devout Catholic. And I was raised Catholic, sort of. I mentioned that before a few weeks ago. But it was always a source of argument in my household because my father wasn't Catholic, but we had to be raised Catholic because of the Catholic Church and marriage and all that. And we went to public school and religious instruction, and there was a lot of resentment there. And so I was always afraid of the Catholic Church and thought God was out there with a baseball bat waiting for me to step out of line. And I was afraid. But this gentleman, this third guy that I sponsored, planted a seed towards a yearning towards having a closer relationship with my Creator, and I'm grateful to him for that. And the other guy is very clear that he taught me how to treat people. He taught me how to behave. He taught me how to act. He taught me how to be a man in all situations, no matter how things are going with me, to always treat people with dignity and respect. And I'm deeply indebted to him. So I'm glad he's with us here. So that's what I've learned about those guys. But let me ask you, I've already talked about the 12th step and about sponsorship, but I have to ask, is the 12th step only about sponsoring other people? And I don't think so. Because I carry the AA message, because that's part of this 12th step. I haven't had a spiritual awakening. I practice these principles in all my affairs. Also about talking with other alcoholics, but to carry these principles and practice them in all my affairs. So I carry the AA message through service, and I strive to practice these principles all the time. I don't have any recovery sponsors right now, but my higher power works in funny ways, because I had a meeting in my district out by Flemington a few months ago. A woman came up to me after the meeting. She asked if I would be her service sponsor. And I said, wow. I'd be honored. I've never been a service sponsor before. So I had to call my service sponsor and ask him, what do I do? He said, well, you know, just got a rule of thumb. And just what I've done with you is I always encourage you to, wherever a position comes up, to give me a call and we'll talk about it and pray about it and see where God leads you. But as it was encouraged to me, I've always been encouraging you to have a job in your home group, in the district, and in the area. And you've got that going on right now. And so just, you know, but as things change and move up, then we'll talk. And so that was good advice. And so my new service sponsee and I are trudging that road, and it's going, it's working well. It's working well. So, and I'm grateful for that. So I mentioned about service, and here's a picture of what I do now in AA that I was led to do and encouraged to do and directed to do since I first joined my home group some almost 9 years ago. I'm currently a secretary for my home group, A Vision for You. I had just finished a term recently of being treasurer. I was treasurer for about 2 years. I'm the past alternate GSR and GSR there. On District 20, which is here, it will be for Union and Clark and Roselle. I was an alternate GSR and GSR serving the district and alternate DCM. Then I moved from my sober house here in Mountainside out to Flemington or out to Bloomsbury, but the district out there is 1521 Flemington, and I started going to those district meetings. And a real active bunch. And wouldn't you know, within a couple of years, I became the literature chair for the district. And I just finished my term recently there in April serving District 1521 as literature chair. So a lot of literature out there. People would come to the meetings, the district meeting, looking to buy big books and stuff, and it was great. So a good experience for me. In the area, since almost 7 years ago, I've been a member of the History and Archives Committee for Area 44, and was really taken aback and blown away that this last fall in November, I was asked by the committee to if I would chair the committee. So my first call was to my sponsor, who wasn't home. I left a message. My second call was to my service sponsor, and he picked up the phone. He says, "What's going on?" And I told him, and he says, "Wow, that sounds great." He says, "A lot of work, but once you pray about it, talk about it with your family, and then ask God's guidance." So I went back the following month and said, "I'll do it if you have me." And so I currently serve as History and Archives Chair for Area 44, and it's a phenomenal experience. I'm also involved in treatment a little bit, almost 7 years now. First Wednesday of every month, I'm in Bergen County Regional Medical Center up in Paramus, where a gentleman who sponsored me before my current sponsor had a commitment up there, and I started going to with him at meetings, and he asked me for a while. He said, would you mind taking over that meeting? And I said, "No, sure." So I'm there the first Wednesday of every month, bringing an AA meeting to the rehab there, F4, I think it's called, whatever that section is, and we call it Bergen Pines. And that's been a great experience. Mostly addicts, but sometimes there's an alcoholic in there. But it's an AA meeting, and I bring that meeting. And I'm blessed to have a guy who was here last week. His name is Chris, who when he can, he also joins, comes in and goes to that meeting. And when I can't go because of other commitments, he covers that meeting. So that's been a wonderful experience. Kind of funny thing. One time I was telling my story, and I talked about Staten Island and being, born and raised there. I was born in 1951, and I went through my story a little bit, and then went on to my drinking and recovery. And after the meeting, a young woman came up to me. She says, "Well, thank you very much, sir, for sharing your story. My mom was born in 1951. I said, "Oh, thank you. That's good to know. Thank you very much." But boy, am I getting old. But good experience. So, to sum up, I was more dead than alive when I came in here 10 years ago yesterday. And even after my body started to heal, I was spiritually sick. I knew I needed to quit drinking, and I didn't know what to do about it. And all pretenses were gone. I needed help, and I was desperate. I had the desperation of that drowning man. And I was led by God to Alcoholics Anonymous and into a sponsor, into a home group, and into service. And there are little steps along the way that pop out to me that let me know that my higher power is looking out for me. The first was, I think, in February 2008, when I was taking a shower. I might have mentioned this. I was in that sober house, and the thought came to me that I can't remember the last time I thought about drinking. And that floored me, because, as you know, that's all I thought about for years. And I called my sponsor afterwards, and he said, "Great, see you Thursday." But that blew me away, and I felt a closeness to God there. A little while later, it was in May, I was out in San Diego, my first trip to San Diego after being back here for 5 years. And I was nervous being on that plane when that drink cart started coming down, and white-knuckling it, and praying, and got through that okay. But I was just starting on my fourth step then, and so I was calling my sponsor a few times that week. And I went to a meeting at noon, outside of San Diego, a town called Poway. And while I'm in that meeting, it was a great meeting. People were sharing and talking about recovery. And I thought, well, this is an awesome meeting. And I thought, I've been here before. And I thought back to the late 1990s when my physician strongly encouraged me to start going to AA. I mean, strongly encouraged me, because he could see where I was and what was going on. And so I finally went to a meeting, and I had a suit on because it was noon during the day because I was supposed to be working. And I remember standing in the back and hoping nobody would recognize me and thinking, I don't have anything in common with these people. And I couldn't wait to get out the door, and I was blushing. And it was the same meeting that I was at in 2008, I'm sure, but I had no ears to hear it because I was so consumed with me and what did people think of me. And all that, not about what the message was. So I had to thank God for that moment too. Later on that year, that Thanksgiving, I was asked by my sister to house and dog sit for her, while her husband has his whole family lives in Northern Jersey, but they were all going to someplace in the Poconos in Pennsylvania for the Thanksgiving weekend, a family reunion. So I went to my sister's house with 5 dogs. My sister's 2 dogs, and each of her married daughters have a dog, so there was a third dog. Anyway, there were 5 dogs and me. And everything's going okay, and it's a nice weekend. And while they're gone, the thought comes to me, I could go have a drink and no one would know. They're all gone. And that made me feel real uncomfortable. I mean, really uncomfortable. And I pushed that thought away. And a while later, and you know, the thought came back again. I said, you can go to the liquor store just right on the other side of the cemetery there. And I used to go there all the time. I used to rotate liquor stores, of course. But you can buy, even get those little airline bottles of vodka. No one would know. There's nobody here. And I'm almost feeling sick to my stomach now. I'm just feeling really queasy. And I pushed that thought away, too. And what I hadn't mentioned yet is that my dad used to wear hats. He was born in 1913, and in the 40s a lot of men wore hats, and still to today, but especially in the 40s and 50s. And after he died, his hat rack went to my mom, and it's still inside my sister's front door, right at the foot of the stairs, this hat rack. And one of my dad's hats was there, actually a couple of them. And when my mom was still alive, when one of my dad's hats would fall down, we'd put it back up. And it would fall down again. We think, Dad's trying to sell us something. He's mad about something. He's, you know, we're real superstitious, you know. And I'm like, we got to check on Mom, make sure she's okay. And we call up my mom. Oh, yeah, everything's fine. But still, we're superstition about this hat thing falling down. So I'm having these thoughts about drinking and pushing these thoughts away and feeling really nervous and queasy about it. And one of my dad's hats falls down. So I put the hat back up. And I'm still feeling really just out of sorts about this, and the hat falls down again, and now I'm really scared. And I had recently gotten a cell phone, and I texted text to my sister saying, Dad's hat keeps falling and I don't know why. It was about 2 hours later, I got a text from my sister saying, maybe he's proud of you. She didn't know anything about me thinking about going to the liquor store and getting some vodka because no one would know and they're all gone. I could get away with it. She didn't know about me going and getting the little airline bottles. She didn't know anything about that, but that's what God put in her head to type to me. And I just sat there and cried. Thank you, God. My last experience that I'll share with you had to do, and Glenn was a part of this. I had no insurance and not working, and I had a lump on my neck, and it kept started getting lower, bigger and bigger and bigger. And Glenn helped me find a doctor and up in Hackettstown and get into a clinic, and then they wanted to do a biopsy, and then turned that there was cancer cells, and now we're all scared about that, and on it goes, and turns out that I've got tonsil cancer. This is in April of 2014. What do we do now? So now we're looking for a doctor to put my tonsils, and this growth is still growing. So Glenn went with me to Parsippany. We met this one guy, the doctor who became my ENT, still is. And wonderful guy, young guy. Remind me of Bob Costas. We could call him Bob Costas. And Glenn was with me on that first visit, and we talked about AA and talked about recovery because I'm filling out the form and all that. Explained I was an alcoholic. I must have had made an impression with him, because on July 1st of that year, I'm at St. Clair's Hospital in Denville to have my tonsils removed. And I'm on this gurney, and I'm going down the hallway, and I go by this giant cross, just like this one, the Franciscan cross, which reminded me of being at St. Christopher's when I was in rehab, because it's run by the Franciscans, the Friars of the Atonement, and I just felt peaceful about, that reminded me of God's with me. And we got into the operating room, and this older woman came up, and she introduced herself as the head nurse in the OR, and she says, "I understand you're a friend of Bill's," out of the blue, and I said, "Yeah, I am." She says, "Well, I've been sober 22 years. And you see the little guy over there, Jose? He's been sober 6 months." She said, "We didn't plan it that way." I said, "No, but God did. He wanted to let me know that he was here." And he was, and I was so much at peace during that surgery and the chemo and radiation afterwards. I knew that God is right here, and he has been. And I'm so thankful for that. So I'm a blessed guy. I was more dead than alive 10 years ago, and I'm here shouting the praises of Alcoholics Anonymous, because Alcoholics Anonymous saves lives, and it certainly saved mine. And I've been honored to be able to share with you for the last 4 weeks, and I look forward to coming back every Sunday and getting to know more of you as well, but it's been such a blessing for me. Thank you. That's all I got.
Thank you.